sunny for the morning, then partly sunny and hot for the afternoon, a high of 87. Right now, humidity high at 86%, 70 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's not all that often that I do fiction on the morning show. It's more of a non-fiction program. But every so often, a novel will cross my path that has some kind of compelling substance to it and the opportunity to talk about some interesting things. And that is proven to very much be the case with a new novel called Frank's Shadow. It's by a writer by the name of Doug McIntyre, who is based in Los Angeles and has worked extensively in radio, television, stage, film, an experienced columnist for the Southern California News Group, which includes the Los Angeles Daily News. And he has done work, among other things, on a documentary called Trying to Get Good, The Jazzazzacy of Jack Sheldon. This, I believe, is his first novel, Frank's Shadow, a deeply personal novel, which has at its heart the intersection between someone who has just passed away and the legendary Frank Sinatra, a connection between these two very different figures that is very, very intriguing as well. And I am really excited to speak with Doug McIntyre about his novel, Frank Shadow, which is published by Greenleaf. Doug McIntyre, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, it's an absolute pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. One of the other reasons why this pitch attracted my attention and interest is because, as it so happens, I lost my dad to cancer just over a year ago. And so it was intriguing to me to read a novel which has at its heart a character who has just lost his dad, albeit under different circumstances than I lost my dad. And as it turns out, I'm very different from the protagonist in this novel, and my father was very different from this protagonist's father. But just the idea of thinking about loss and what we do in the midst of loss was very attractive to me. And I have to say, your novel has not disappointed me one bit. It's a fascinating novel, and I'm really glad to talk with you about it. Can you just say a word about how this stacks up to all of the other writing that you have done in your professional life? And is this indeed your first novel? And what did it feel like to embark on this kind of writing?
Well, it is my first novel. And since it took me 25 years, literally 25 years from conception to the bookshelves, it's likely to be my last novel, or I'll be 160 when the next one comes out. but, you know, I've been a professional writer for 45 years, and I always considered the novel to be sort of the pinnacle of writing, the greatest challenge, the greatest reward. And it's proven to be so, because you know, writing for television has mostly, or film, has mostly been, you know, you're limited by the clock and you're limited by the technology available, whereas a novel, you can go inside a character's head to reveal their inner thoughts, which can be done successfully in film or television. It's very difficult to do. So that was the great joy of doing it. This book was actually born in 1998, the day that Frank Sinatra died. I should say the evening that Frank Sinatra was died. I had a good friend of mine whose dad died the exact same day and was approximately the same age as Sinatra. And it occurred to me that one death was satellite news ricocheting around the world, and the other guy was in the back of the paper by the mattress ads and the racing results, and the family had to pay to put him there. And having worked for many, many decades in Hollywood and with a lot of famous people, it started as a meditation on the nature of celebrity itself and how we sort of value lives. And I conceived the idea of a young man, a 40-year-old history professor with his own problems, going home to bury his father and realizing he knows everything about the famous singer, but almost nothing about his own dad of substance, who was a sort of Silent Sam, Greatest Generation, Irish immigrant, World War II vet. And he launches out to discover who his father really was, substantively. And I think that there's a universality to that, because, Greg, those of us who grew up with those less communicative parents, I think that there's a relationship between children and parents that is fictitious in a lot of ways. As kids, we see our parents as these giant figures in our lives because they are, and we have them up on pedestals. And as we age, we have to start to recognize their humanity, their warts and all reality of life. And parents who are handed these little babies and see them as perfect beings, as we age, they have to start to realize that their children have flaws too, that they're not all perfect little angels, that they have disappointments and failures and make mistakes. And it's squaring the math of that that I think is Danny McKenna's struggle in this book as he discovers who his father really was. He has to reconcile that. And I think that that's the universal truth that I was looking for.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, I'm not going to prattle on endlessly about my own dad and, you know, my loss, but I do want to say that one thing that reading your book really helped me do is newly appreciate how my father was very different from the deceased father in your novel. I mean, in contrast to someone kind of taciturn, not prone to talk about himself, to reveal too much, my father, in addition to being a retired clergyman, was also a professional storyteller. And most of his stories were actually stories about his own life, in some cases a bit embellished. But I felt like, and also the fact that when we received the diagnosis of his terminal illness, those last several months were, if anything, a heightened experience of revelation, of stories being told, of us asking questions and so on. Precisely the opposite situation of your protagonist and probably a whole lot of other people who, for various reasons, have never had that kind of connection with a parent that they have suddenly lost, and they realize that door has closed permanently, and there will be no more opportunities to ask them questions about who they were or what they believed or what they thought life was all about. I mean, it's really sobering to think about somebody who finds themselves in that kind of situation.
Yeah, my father passed away while I was working on the book. And while I can't necessarily pin the shaping of the novel on that event, it certainly heightened exactly that experience that, you know, when they're gone for good. And, you know, I know that you have to consider yourself blessed that you had a father who was communicative, who was a storyteller, because even the embellished stories, in a way, offer an insight into who we are. How people want to portray themselves is an indicator of who their inner life, what their inner life was really about. My lead character, Danny McKenna, has a dad, Francis Xavier McKenna, was an Irish immigrant. Came over in 1929 and ended up in World War II and experienced the trauma in World War II that he considered a great shame and hid from everybody. And as a result, when Danny discovers that, he has to wrestle with this new piece of information that recasts his father in a different light. And then ask the big question, would it have made any difference if he had told me? And I think for most of us, the answer is no. There are dads, there are moms. We love them anyway. But and how much easier Francis Xavier McKenna's life would have been had he been able to unburden himself to the people closest to him. And that's where the parallel life of Frank Sinatra comes in. Frank Sinatra is not really, it's not about Frank Sinatra, this book. He's one of the two Franks that casts a shadow because young Danny McKenna is a musical oddball. At 40 years of age in 1998, he should be listening to rock and roll. But the music of his life is the American Songbook, represented by the artistry of Frank Sinatra. And Sinatra has his own secrets in life, and he revealed his truths through the way he sang. In fact, actually said, when asked why he didn't write an autobiography, he said, "I can't sing in a book." And so he knew that his truth was most revealed when he was standing in front of a band, in front of a microphone, in front of an audience. But the Sinatra character in the book is just a parallel life. You know, we see this all the time, Greg. Even the submarine disaster, the submersible disaster that we all just experienced, we covered it relentlessly in the media because it had a connection to the Titanic and it was inherently dramatic. But because of the Titanic connection, somehow it vaguely connected us to Leonardo DiCaprio. And yet we lose thousands of people a year who are trying to escape massive, horrific poverty on driftwood rafts going across the Mediterranean or coming across the Caribbean. And they're invisible. Their lives are lost without us even noting them. And that's the value we seem to put on celebrity over, oftentimes, the people that we're living with.
Hmm. A last kind of overarching question before we probe a little further into the novel itself and the story you tell. I know there's a fancy word for it when at the outset of a book there's a quotation from somebody else, and you have two of them. One is from Emily Dickinson, but I want to ask you about the second one. Alan Sherman, you quote him as saying, "Of all the people you are ever going to meet, you will know your mother and father the least." That's such an interesting thing to say, and I suspect, you know, there's some danger in making a generalization like that, and I'm sort of case number one of that, and yet I suspect that there really is some truth there, and you must think so too if Alan Sherman's book words adorn the first page of your novel. Tell us more about why those words are here and the truth that you see in them.
Well, it's interesting. I had the first epigram from day one, really. Fame is a fickle food served upon a shifting plate. Men eat of it and die, by Emily Dickinson. And I do think that fame can destroy. It's a form of a non-narcotic narcotic, if that makes sense, for a lot of people. But the other one I didn't stumble upon until very late in the process. Alan Sherman, the guy who sang Camp Granada, "Hello, Mother, Hello, Father," not exactly the type of person you usually look for literary quotes. But he wrote that, and when I read his biography, I realized he had a very, very troubled relationship with his own peculiar parents. And I think that there's some truth in that generally. And as I mentioned before, I think that our parents play the role of parents for many years in our lives because they want to set the proper example for us. And by doing so, they scrub the senior details of their own lives. They don't talk about when they had pimples, when they were nervous kids on their first teenage dates, when they may have been involved in some shenanigans that they don't want you to be involved in, but they themselves performed the same acts that they're now grounding you for. And as a result, it robs them of their humanity. And that's part of the path that children have to reconcile the humanity of our parents with the reality of them being your mom and dad. And I really think that the quicker you can get to squaring the math on that, the more open and the closer your relationship can be with your mom and dad.
Hmm. We're speaking with Doug McIntyre, and we're talking about his novel, Frank's Shadow. Frank, really, in the title, we're talking probably primarily about the legendary singer Frank Sinatra. But there is another important Frank in this novel, namely Francis Xavier Frank McKenna, who has just passed away. And it is one of his sons who is reeling from that unexpected loss and trying to contend with his mixed feelings about his father, a man that he feels like in many ways he scarcely knew, and a man for whom he must offer a eulogy at his upcoming funeral. And that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg of a really interesting, complex story. Doug McIntyre, the very first chapter of the book is titled Last Dance, and it unfolds on April 26, 1994, with the news that has just been announced that Frank Sinatra has died. You have the character recalling the experience that he had of seeing Frank Sinatra live in performance just a few years earlier, and it was very definitely Frank Sinatra in decline. You describe this performance so vividly, so authentically. I have to ask, is that something that you ever experienced in person, or did you see some sort of footage of Frank Sinatra struggling through one of those latter life performances? Where does this opening chapter come from? It is so intriguing.
Well, it's one of the two scenes in the book that are really almost journalism. Sinatra died on May 14th, 1998, which was the same night as the last episode of Seinfeld, by the way. But on April 26th, 1994, I saw his last performance in New York City at Radio City Music Hall. It was a one-off. He had done a two-week run there and missed the show because of illness. And I happened to be in the city and scored a ticket in the second row. So I described it pretty much verbatim as I remember it. I wrote it down contemporaneously, so I had really good notes on it. So that's the opening. I just put my character in the seat as opposed to me being in the seat. And I found it poignant because everybody sort of intuitively knew that he was never going to be in New York City on stage again. And as it turns out, he wasn't. And he struggled through the show. But at one point, when disaster strikes and Sinatra lost the lyric to Mac the Knife, he had giant teleprompters to bring the word to read the words, but he just couldn't find it. And the audience basically gave him a standing ovation in the middle of the song, and it moved him. You could see it. You could see his eyes enlarge. And then everything kicked in, and he finished the song brilliantly. And it was just this incredible emotional transaction between a person who virtually nobody in the audience ever met, but felt as if they had known their whole lives. Because any artist, Greg, as a music person yourself, you'll understand this. If the music doesn't move the audience, then you failed. If a painting, if a poem, if a novel, if a comedian doesn't make you laugh, they have failed. And this is why I think many times you'll see people feel the loss of an entertainer very strongly. We wonder, why in the world are people crying because Tina Turner died? Well, they didn't know Tina Turner, but they did know Tina Turner. Her music moved them, was part of their lives. You know, Uncle Carl gets drunk at the Thanksgiving dinner table or makes rude jokes or asks you for money. Tina Turner brought joy into your life. Well, so as a result, this last performance of Sinatra's at Radio City Music Hall was really New Yorkers' way of saying thank you for a lifetime connection that we've had, even if we never actually met. And then Danny McKenna, my lead character, when he realizes his father is dead, on the same day that Frank Sinatra died, he wants to figure out what possible connection, and because he's a historian, he starts by telling me, famous tale of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson dying on the exact same day, July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. They had so much to do with creating. And the country believed that that simultaneous death of the two foundingists of the founding fathers had to mean something. It had a higher meaning, that God had blessed the creation of America. And Danny wants to know, well, what possible connection could there be between Frank Sinatra and my father, Francis Xavier McKenna? And that's what he, that's the question, the sort of philosophic, emotional question that he strives to answer throughout the course of the story.
Absolutely. And again, just to make sure people, our listeners understand, you have Frank Sinatra and Frank McKenna dying on the same day and being born on the same day, December 12th, 1915. So it seems like the most incredible of coincidences. And your main character, Danny, is desperate to find some kind of monumental connection between these two very, very different men. And I have to say, you know, maybe it's partly because I'm also a voice teacher and so on, that and something of a performer. I sympathize with that elderly Frank Sinatra on stage and struggling and so on. And I think you write so beautifully about those adoring fans in the audience who see this. This is one of the things you say in that chapter, first chapter of Frank's Shadow. In this moment where it all starts to kind of fall apart, you write, "This was our fault. We were the ones still buying the tickets with unrealistic expectations. The ravages of all those late nights, all those tumblers of Jack Daniels, all the broad smokes and temper tantrums had collected their pound of flesh. Dean was dead, Sammy was dead, Count Basie was dead, JFK was dead, Ava was dead, music was dead. Fans are enablers, so we forgave him. No, that's not right. We loved him even more. We knew and he knew this was it, his last performance in the city that loved him like no other. A little later, he was a ruin, but so is the Acropolis, and people still marvel at it."
Well, I'm glad you targeted that line about the Acropolis. Is one of my personal favorite lines in the book, because I happen to have great affection for older performers. I mean, obviously, at my age, I should have grown up with rock and roll, and I did grow up with rock and roll, but as I mentioned earlier, the passion, the musical passion of my life was the songbook, the Irving Berlins and the Gershwins and the Cole Porters and the Johnny Mercers, those incredible songs that were written from basically the late 20s into the late 50s. But I, you know, when older performers don't have the same purity of voice, they don't have the same power that they have at the peak of their abilities, and Sinatra certainly did not at the end have the ability that he had in the 50s and the early to mid 60s, but he had a magnetism, a charisma, a history that was inherently dramatic. And by the way, his frailty created its own weather system of tension in the room, and tension is very dramatic whether it's in theater or in a film or whatever. So the concerts became sort of mini dramas. Would he make it? Would he get through it? And sometimes he did, and sometimes he didn't. But we all knew that this was a cultural historic event to be in the room with him, a cross-generational thing where grandparents would take their grandchildren to these shows because someday their grandkids would be able to say, you know, I saw Sinatra live. Which, you know, the more the years pile up, the more it sounds like you saw Jolson at the Winter Garden, and you saw Caruso or something. And if you're interested in the history of music or the history that connects the generations, these events are important. I think people certainly were flocking to Tony Bennett when he was still performing with the same thought in mind. Although Bennett, much to his astonishing credit, had astonishing vocal powers, right? Still his 95th birthday. I still can't figure out how he did that.
Hmm. And I'm reminded, speaking of Caruso, your line about the Acropolis is echoes something that somebody said about the great Maria Callas when she embarked on a very ill-advised final concert tour long after she'd retired from the opera stage, and her voice is in tatters, and she's nothing close to what she had been, and yet adoring fans flocked. And one of those fans famously remarked, to whoever they were with. You're right. It's like the, and named some kind of famous ruined painting. It's like that. It's a wreck of a picture, but the picture is the greatest picture in the world. So even if it's, you know, in its substance, not nearly what it was, it's like you have all of the memories of what it once was. And in that moment, it's almost enough.
And this is what we do with our parents. When our parents are gone, we remember when they were at the peak of their skills. I mean, even if you have a long, protracted exit from this life and you deal with an elderly parent who fades, that becomes a sweet memory, too, because you had the time to say goodbye. So human life is complex. And our feelings, we have logic and we have feelings, and they get intermingled. And sometimes we struggle to separate the two. And sometimes we revel in the two, the fact that they are intertwined. And hopefully that will be the takeaway for folks who read Frank Shadow.
Hmm. So you have your main character of Danny McKenna saddled with the responsibility of delivering the eulogy at his father's funeral. And he is thinking, as you share it with us, "I accept my assignment with genuine reservations. My attempt to duck Dad's eulogy is not based on humility. I am the most qualified, that is, if it were a eulogy for anyone other than my father. Here's what I can't tell them, what I'm ashamed to admit. I have no more idea what to say about Francis McKenna than I would if asked to give the eulogy for the Haitian busboy who was scraping breadcrumbs off our tablecloth with a plastic pocket comb." And it's so interesting to think about somebody being in that situation. I mean, it's scary enough to deliver a eulogy for your own father's funeral, but scarier still when you feel like you don't know who this man really was.
Well, my character is the youngest in the family, and his father was 42 when he was born. So he did not experience a young dad the way his older brothers did. And because of the nature of his father being the silent Sam that he wasn't particularly communicative. So Danny knows some dry facts about his father. He has snippets of stories. But he also is maybe an overthinker. And he wants to probe deeper. I mean, he certainly could get up there and give a sort of boilerplate eulogy the way so many of us do or receive when our time comes. And we've all been at funeral services when the minister, through no fault of his own, is tasked with performing a funeral service for somebody who he never met and has to sort of keep his comments, his or her comments, on a generic plane. But Danny wants to go deeper. He wants it to be substantive. He wants it to be revelatory, but he can't do that because he doesn't feel like he has that information, that he has that insight into his dad. So, that's really a reflection more on his character than on anybody else, because I think his other brothers, had they been asked to do the eulogy, would have been happy to say, "My father was born in Ireland in 1915 and came to this country and lived his life and fought for the country," and he would have just checked the boxes. Danny wants to have some keen insight, and of course that's what he goes and actually discovers.
I don't know that you want to necessarily maybe reveal this, but I think we should at least mention in a vague fashion that something kind of shocking, very shocking, happens at, I guess we'd call it, the visitation, where people are coming and the casket is right there. And somebody comes, a stranger comes, and does something which is shocking and horrifying. I'll let you tell our listeners what that is if you want to. But otherwise, I just want you to talk about that sort of moment of realization when Danny and his brothers realize that their father had done something to inspire what seems to be out-and-out hatred from this stranger who has suddenly arrived. And it's really interesting to think about something like that occurring, that in a sense totally reshapes our ideas about who this who this dearly departed, deceased person is or was. Did anything in particular inspire you to create this dramatic moment in the novel?
Actually, no. This is one of those, you know, fortunate, you know, blips of the brain that, as a writer, occasionally you come up with an idea that, wow, I don't think I've ever seen that before in a story. And I wanted to have an incident that would be a mystery to everybody that Danny McKenna would then have to solve about his father. So, and I don't think it ruins the experience for anybody out there who wants to read the book. But at the wake, it's an open casket, and an elderly World War II era veteran comes in wearing his, you know, garrison hat, and they're all expecting him to snap a salute. They don't know who this elderly person is, but clearly another World War II veteran here to say goodbye to a fallen comrade. And instead, he spits in their father's face in the casket, and they're totally shocked. I mean, completely stunned by this. And they can't for the life of them figure out what – they couldn't conceive that their father could be responsible for such hatred, that someone would do something like that. Because they, you know, and this is what they, you know, that Danny talks about. Frank Sinatra was loved and hated. Frank Sinatra certainly had fans, but he also had people who didn't like him. But they couldn't conceive that their father didn't have fans. He had family who loved him, and that was enough for him. But they couldn't conceive that he could be responsible for the opposite side of love, which is hatred. And that's certainly what kicks off the quest to uncover what was that about, and that ultimately will lead Danny to discover who his father really was.
Right. And of course, one thing that's also intriguing about your novel is that it is set in the mid-1990s, just ahead of most of us being able to hop on the internet and conduct such a search with the kind of tools that have now become almost commonplace. I mean, this is a search that has to be done in libraries and archives and with microfilm and microfiche. And that's, I mean, the way once upon a time would conduct a search like that. And that's a really intriguing aspect of this story, I think, as well.
Greg, I'm so glad you grabbed onto that, because it's one of the things that was the most surprising. You know, again, I started the book in 1998, so I was writing it contemporaneously, and then it sat for a long, long time because I didn't know what the family secret was. I didn't know what Francis Xavier McKenna's. Everything I tried to come up with was either awful or stolen or both. And then, so it sat for many, many years, until I finally was reading something else and the light bulb went off. Like, oh, now I know how to do it. But in the meantime, the world changed because we had social media was born. Google was born. So all of these things that you can do in 5 seconds with a URL you can do it on your phone, were things that used to require going to the library or taking a subway to take a boat out to Ellis Island to go through the immigration records. And you needed the skill of an historian to track down documents from archives. And so in a way, you know, Danny becomes a sort of, you know, hungover detective, you know, using his skills as an historian to go research his own father's path to America and to find out, well, what ship did he come over on? And, you know, where did he go when he got to America in 1929? What path did he follow? All of those things you could do very quickly today, but back in 1998, doesn't seem that long ago, but it's a world away.
Well, that's just one of the compelling facets of your really wonderful novel, which is, again, titled Frank's Shadow, published by Greenleaf Book Group, and the author, Doug McIntyre. Doug McIntyre, congratulations on a really fantastic novel. I'm glad that after its long gestation, it is finally here. I have enjoyed it very, very much, and also enjoyed talking with you about it. Thank you so much.
Well, Greg, thanks so much. It was a total pleasure, and I really appreciate your giving me the time.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. And late into the night, and I mean late into the night, I was finishing up a wonderful novel, a thriller called Once a Spy by Keith Thompson. And this is a book that indeed you cannot put down. And it takes us into the hazy and scary world of intelligence and counterintelligence agents, and thrusts right into the middle of it all the unexpected presence of Alzheimer's disease, and also the give and take between a father and son, one who has a great deal of experience in this world and the other with really no experience whatsoever. And together they are trying to weather one incredible challenge after another. The result is this really remarkable novel, again called Once a Spy, which has been published by Doubleday. And Keith Thompson, its author, joins me for the next few minutes to talk about it and about his life. Keith Thompson, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Greg, thanks for having me.
I found this to be such an inventive novel. I really enjoyed it so much. I read your biography on the dust jacket with some disbelief, I must say. It says here you are a former semi-pro baseball player in France, an editorial cartoonist for Newsday, a filmmaker, a screenwriter. That seems like an interesting stew of various pursuits that have been part of your life. Does that have anything to do with the inventiveness of this novel?
If you're a baseball player in the French League, you should be thinking about another career. I drew cartoons, and it just seemed like it'd be fun to have more than one picture per second. So I made a short film, and that led me into movies, and writing movies has led me into books. So it's probably not as scattershot as it might seem.
Well, at any rate, it's intriguing, as is this novel. How much writing have you done before this, and in particular, full-length novels? Is this your first?
My graduate school thesis was published by St. Martin's Press. It was a book about pirates. About three copies were sold, all of them to my mother. I've worked also quite a bit as a national security reporter. I write a column for the Huffington Post, and Once a Spy has enabled me to sort of write what you know.
Right. I was going to get to that the one aspect of your biography which ties very nicely into this is indeed the work that you do on intelligence, writing about the intelligence community. How did you happen to fall into that line of work and develop the expertise that you have?
I guess, like any other reporter, I'm just curious and chase after stories, and this is the intelligence community is something that I'm interested in. I wish I had a more intriguing story, like the KGB slipped me a drug, and I went from an interest in pirates to spies, but that's pretty much it.
Nothing as interesting as all that. I guess one of the things that always intrigues me is that it seems to me you are writing about something which, by its very nature, is at least wants to be impenetrable, and which can't make it as easy as if you were going to write about Major League Baseball or write about politics. Is it challenging? I mean, how is it that you're able to know whatever it is that you know about the intelligence world?
Well, I have a wide range of sources, beginning with a guy who's a temp at the National Security Agency, tons of spies. I've spoken to the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and by and large, I've found that if you are discreet in your reporting, they'll in turn be good sources and trust you. And in general, they have agendas just like everybody else in government, so they have things that they want to tell you. Much more difficult to crack was the world of horse players. The main character in my book is a retired spy with Alzheimer's disease, as you mentioned, and his ex-colleagues are trying to neutralize him, which is spy parlance for to kill him, and he turns to his son, who's a horse player, who knows nothing about the father being a spy. All he knows is the horses, and I needed to learn more about the world of horse players, which I knew nothing about. And the people in that world don't want to talk to you. It's sort of like someone who snuck outside to smoke a cigarette and have a whiskey. And I used all my reporter skills and tricks and came up empty. And then it occurred to me to buy them a horse, which means pay for a $2 ticket, and then the floodgates opened. As long as I paid for a $2 ticket at the aqueduct, I could get all the information I wanted.
Wow. At the heart of this story is this older man, a spy / former spy named Drummond, who appears to be suffering from something that either is Alzheimer's or something very much like it. And one of the concepts that is really drives this story is the notion of a spy knowing so much, falling prey to that kind of mental debilitation in which they might inadvertently reveal incredibly sensitive information that could be tremendously damaging to the United States and its security. We can imagine that kind of scenario playing out in real life. It's not all that far-fetched, actually. Did anything in particular inspire that idea? And how much of it kind of matches up with anything which ever has occurred, as far as we know, in real life security?
Well, first of all, it happens all the time insofar as anytime somebody with those sort of secrets goes to the dentist and has anesthesia, a babysitter, as it's known, comes and stands in the dentist's office with him just to make sure that sort of information doesn't get out. In terms of covert operatives with secrets in their head being at risk to lose those secrets as a result of dementia, that happens less because by the time they reach that age, they're generally so far removed from the field that their sources and the technology and the operations are old news. They could pretty much sit and dictate their memoirs to a Pakistani ISI agent and it wouldn't be a huge risk. That said, there are instances where there are people who are much closer to the game. The Central Intelligence Agency director, Bill Colby, was a big player in the intelligence community after he left the CIA, and he was out canoeing in his house by his house in Maryland in I think 1996, and he disappeared for a week. And people wondered, you know, how can a guy with secrets like that in his head just disappear for a week? The canoe came back, but they couldn't find him. They dredged the river and nothing. And people were just imagining this 72-year-old man sitting in the proverbial damp, dark room with a dangling light bulb over his head at the hands of our enemies. And a week later, his body turned up. He had evidently died of hypothermia as a result of a heart attack and falling out of his canoe. The hypothetical intrigued me enough to write a 320-page book.
and a great book it is. Another thing that is intriguing here is the notion that somebody with Alzheimer's would nevertheless have these flashes of lucidity, as your main character does, and you write with what seems like great persuasiveness about the way an older person with this kind of dysfunction might cope. Did you try to study Alzheimer's and how that disease typically affects somebody?
More than anything, I researched Alzheimer's. I worked with a neuropsychologist to make sure that everything was right and to get a handle on it. What he experiences are episodes of lucidity, which range from 2 minutes to 40 minutes and come at random. And during those moments, the Alzheimer's sufferer can connect to memories that he might not the rest of the time. These episodes occur at random. The psychologist that I worked with likened it to a basketball player of middling ability who just hits four three-pointers in a row. It just happens. There's just not that much explanation for it.
One of the things that makes this this book especially wonderful is that we have this sort of odd couple of father and son, the one who is a former and maybe always a spy, and the other who has not been part of that world at all. And, of course, you end up then with this kind of oil and water mixture between the two of them, with the son, of course, more than anything, perpetually bewildered. Were you patterning this after anything else that maybe you've written about before, or did anything in particular inspire you to choose this? Certainly turns out to be fertile ground for your book.
I was just intrigued by the notion of sacrifice. A lot of covert operatives, the casualties are their families, especially when they're patriotic and eternally vigilant, as Drummond is. And the person who was left wanting was his son. And his son is a bright guy who's kind of a math genius, and he went to the track instead of maybe pursuing a more standard math genius course. He's the victim of his father's heroism. So they come to terms during the course of this book, or they try to.
As they connect at one point with another character who I will not name, this person, in kind of describing the life one has in doing intelligence work, says this: if only covert operations took place at the Casino de Monte Carlo. In reality, the job is mostly paperwork. The action, what there is of it, rarely gets more glamorous than bad coffee with a frightened local in a place with a lousy ventilation system. And that's if you're lucky enough that your man remembers the appointment. But the brief moments when we do learn something, product that actually advances our position, make it worth it. It's interesting that you have a character describing intelligence work that way, because actually, of course, very little of what unfolds in your novel sounds anything like that. It sounds like and looks more like what we think of as intelligence work.
Well, if there weren't unusual things, if it weren't an unusual day in a life of a spy, it wouldn't be much of a novel. It'd be tedious, sort of like the life that character is describing. That speech is based in part on a diatribe that a spy that I know likes to give against James Bond. James Bond has a weakness for women and cars and martinis, and in reality an enemy could exploit any of those things to get him to give up the crown jewels. The reality is more of a paperwork and filing cables and getting approvals existence, certainly.
One thing that is said about Drummond is that the qualities that made him a good spy, a natural, made him a poor husband. Can you just say a word about that and about how true you think that would typically play out for someone in this line of work?
I think that anybody who has been a workaholic or has lived with a workaholic can probably relate to that. And he is obsessed to an unhealthy extent with national security from the standpoint of his family, from the standpoint of 300 million Americans. It's not unhealthy. It's great. It's great that we have people like that.
The book, again, is Once a Spy. It's a marvelous novel published by Doubleday and the author, Keith Thompson. Keith Thompson, I love your book, and I'm glad we got to talk today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Greg, I appreciate your having me. Thank you.
It is 8:59. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music. on your gateway to public radio. Coming up at 9:01, we'll have the news, and at 9:04, we will join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming. Let's get you up to speed on the weather details now from